thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 9. For the 4th of July, 2007. Too much information. I'm Dan Cohen. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. We're glad to have you back. And we're here today with the regular roundtable, Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, good to talk to you guys. And we'll kick right in with the most obvious question that's at the top of everyone's minds, and I'll ask the question of the two of you. Are you now or will you ever be an iPhone user? Mills?
I think it's unlikely that I'm going to be, only because I have this really bad habit of losing phones or dropping them in bodies of water and things like that. And so I tend to get the cheapest possible cell phone I can buy, just because then when I do drop it in a lake, I just don't feel so bad. But that's not to say I don't want an iPhone. It's just that I know better than to actually go and buy an iPhone.
Okay. Tom?
Yeah, and I mean, at $600 a pop, I think, you know, definitely not something you want to drop in the lake. I am not the owner of an iPhone, but I may someday be the owner of an iPhone. I actually just bought a like 3 weeks ago, knowing that the iPhone was going to come out. So, you know, I wasn't caught by surprise or anything. But I bought a BlackBerry Curve, and I
a nice phone.
Made a very considered decision as to whether to buy the BlackBerry or the iPhone. And we can talk about the reasons that I did that. But I think I'm keeping my options open. I think, you know, in a year or something, maybe I'll spring and get the iPhone. I'm kind of a gadget hound, so it wouldn't surprise me if I ended up with one,
right.
And it would definitely surprise my wife.
Well, you know, I mean, you guys know that I'm a gadget hound too, especially with regards to Apple products, and so I imposed a restraining order on myself not to go within 200 yards of an Apple store for the next 6 months. But then yesterday I was out with my kids going food shopping, and right next to the supermarket was a brand new AT&T store.
Uh-oh.
And it was like right there, and I couldn't do anything about it. And so I grabbed even Arlo and we went inside, and I said, Daddy has to look at a phone. And I actually played around with it for a while. Have the two of you had a chance to actually try one?
I'm no. Like you. I have to keep it out of my hands, and that
right.
way I can't actually buy one.
Right. Well, let me say, actually, I have to say, you know, people are saying what a great job Apple did with, like, the hype factor and the publicity and the ramping up and things like that. But I have to say it was a slight letdown, actually, when I used it, just because I had already seen all the functionality in the videos and the blogs and things like that. And so, in an odd way, like, if they had just announced it and said it's available now in the stores, I think I would have been more impressed than I actually was. And I think, actually, the biggest problem was, and I intentionally did this to make sure I wouldn't walk out of the store with one, of course, they have them all set to use the Wi-Fi connection in the AT&T stores.
Yes.
And right. so I just fidgeted with it and turned it off so it would go onto the cellular network, and it really was slow. And so I have to say that I think I need to wait for, you know, the next generation version. And people say, well, it'll be, you know, Wi-Fi, and of course this is a good segue, because on campus you could think, well, you'd have this sort of ubiquitous Wi-Fi connection. But, you know, actually in our building, we have ubiquitous Wi-Fi, but you have to log on through the browser. It's not a seamless experience. And I think that unless this is on Wi-Fi, it is painful when you're using like Google Maps or the Safari web browser. And, you know, so I think I'm just going to wait on it. And I feel like a storm has passed and I'm not going to whip out my credit card and buy one of these things right away.
Yeah, I think that the slowness of the connection is a problem, and I don't think Wi-Fi is really a real alternative to a cell phone or a real wireless connection. Because you know, if I'm somewhere where they have Wi-Fi, chances are I also have my laptop in my bag. It's when I don't have my laptop in my bag when I'm, you know, or I can't access my laptop if I'm in the car or if I'm out on the weekend or something that I want this connectivity. I think the decision I made to get the BlackBerry instead of the iPhone, I really made it on the basis of the keyboard. And I realized that for me, the thing I needed most was a good email terminal. A mobile email terminal. I live in email. Email is my killer app. And the lack of a keyboard, a real touch keyboard, a tactile keyboard on the iPhone just did it for me. I thought, you know, 90% of what I'm going to use this for, other than making phone calls, is email. You know, I'm not really going to listen to music on it. I'm not going to watch YouTube, even if that was possible with the connection. I'm gonna write email. So I bought the one that, you know, the product that has been, you know, doing email and doing it well for years. So that was my decision.
Right. Well, I'll on the keyboard factor, you know, I have a Sidekick. I've had one for a few years. I love it. It's got a great keyboard. The screen flips up and you get a full profile keyboard. So it's a pretty wide keyboard. And I tried typing on this thing and I don't think I got 20% of the letters right. And I know that even with training, you know, I mean, or with training, it should get better, but I'd really worry about that in terms of input. That seems like a huge hurdle for me because I also use the phone for email sometimes, and not having a really fast keyboard is a problem.
Which just goes to show that you're showing your age, because my nephew, who sends approximately 3,000 text messages a month with his phone, can actually text with the phone in his pocket. so that way the teacher in his class cannot see that he's doing this. And so, you know, it's because we grew up with the QWERTY keyboards, and so we want to type that way. Where in his case, he just, you know, punches all the buttons with one thumb and away he goes.
And then are the SMS messages kind of piped directly into his brain because he can't take the phone out of his pocket to see the screen and see the response?
You know, if he could have a microchip embedded, he would certainly do it. Because I asked him that question one day. I said, well, if you could have a chip embedded in your brain that would just send the messages directly, he said, oh, yeah. I'd be at first in line. So, and I think he's not all that atypical of America's teenagers.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about the iPhone stuff the other day. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Gartner's hype cycle.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, it has the five phases of the hype cycle. So that the technology trigger, then the peak of inflated expectations, then the trough of disillusionment, the slope of enlightenment, and the plateau of productivity. So it'll be very interesting to see how long it takes the iPhone to dip into the trough of disillusionment. There was certainly a brief dip over the weekend due to getting their people's service started on time. But I think that Apple is probably going to be sorry that they hitched their wagon to AT&T's network on this, because I'm a recovering AT&T wireless user, and their network is just substandard, at least around here in the Washington area. And we moved to a house, you know, new house in a different part of the same service area, and all of a sudden couldn't get a signal. And there are four cell phone towers close to us, and none of them were giving us a signal. So it's a slow network compared to the others, and I think that Apple may end up being sorry that with this phone that creates all these expectations of moving around large amounts of data, AT&T's network may not have been the right choice.
Right. Well, I just think that when you play with it, I mean, the user interface is spectacular. It really lives up to the hype. But it makes you want to do all these things, at least me, that are non-phone functions. I mean, I want to use the web. I want to use the Google Maps stuff. I could see a lot of interesting applications, and people in the education world have been talking about this, you know, interesting in-the-field applications and, you know, classroom activities and things like that. But if you're using such a slow network, it just the experience basically crashes on you.
And at least for now, it's kind of closed to third-party development. I mean, you can – I mean, essentially they're saying to third-party developers, they're saying, well, you know, go build a web page that works on the mobile Safari, which, you know, seems like –
Right, but that's, again, exactly where the speed issue is huge. I think what they need to do – at least for me, or if I wanted to write an application for this thing, or if someone in academia or museums or libraries, I mean, museums, boy, there could be amazing applications for this, or that you could put up web pages that people could surf to. But if the surfing experience is so slow and you're standing in front of a painting and you want to get a web page and it's taking a minute to load, that experience isn't very great. You might as well preload a device with, you know, as they do with audio tours already, with some information. But I think the way around this, at least with this network, is to really enable developers to create the little widgets like the YouTube widget. It seems to me they have to absolutely do that, because then what you have is all the UI functions and all the drawing functions that take a lot of time as you're downloading, for instance, images from a web page. A lot of that stuff can be preloaded into the phone. And then you're just doing HTTP calls, basically like an AJAX application, where right. you're just grabbing text or maybe some images from the web and putting it into an environment that's already on the phone. And I think that'll make it feel a lot snappier. And I'm surprised they haven't done that already on the phone. You could have some really great third-party apps that basically look like those little widgets on a Mac right now.
Well, I mean, I think the big thing with the iPhone is it seems to me that, you know, if you take any one of these pieces, you know, let's say the Google Maps functionality, there are mobile devices out there that do a better job of mapping, you know, or you take the email functionality. Well, there are like my BlackBerry, I think. There are devices that do a better job of email. But what I think the Apple phone does is, and what I think the important part, the important thing about the Apple phone is the interface and is the user experience. And I think this is what people are saying is Apple's the first company that's really thought about and thought hard about, you know, what do people want to see in a phone? How do they want it to feel? How do they want it to look? And that's really where I think the iPhone, it seems to me from all I've seen, is really pushing forward. This is going to be a device, maybe the first handheld device that people want to use. And Dan, you said it yourself, is it makes you want to use it. The
right.
interface
I think that's critical.
Is exciting.
Design is important here, yeah.
Very important. And I think it's especially important if we're going to engage audiences for educational content, if we're going to engage student audiences. It has to be something they want to do. It can't just be something that, you know, is there but not that interesting.
Right.
So I think that's where the iPhone really pushes forward.
Yep, I agree. Well, in other non-iPhone news, was there any non-iPhone news this past couple of weeks? No, I think there was. and actually, you know, this is sort of a related item that we have from prior episodes of Digital Campus, and it also relates to the iPhone, is Gmail. You know, we had been talking about, you know, maybe universities should throw overboard their ITU departments and, you know, just adopt Google applications like Gmail, where they don't need a lot of servers. They just sort of outsource the whole thing. And indeed, we were so prescient. Right after we said that on the podcast, we discovered that indeed Trinity College Dublin, a beautiful university, if you can get to Dublin, right in the city center, has done that. They're using Gmail now. There are other universities around the globe. And I think one of the Arizona universities was also
Arizona State.
Arizona State. I think it's going to be a big trend. And it seems to me that a lot of students are coming to universities already with Gmail. But it did seem like this is a great way to provide applications, et cetera, without the extreme cost to universities of server support and hardware.
Yeah,
well, sorry, Mills, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that this just goes to show that more and more universities are going to jump on this bandwagon because it is so much less expensive in the long run. And the reason it's less expensive is the staffing dimension of it more than anything else. And as we all know, benefits like healthcare and retirement and these kinds of things are hugely expensive for large organizations. And so to be able to outsource a technology like email is going to be immensely attractive to the business side of the university, to the vice president for fiscal affairs or whoever that person is. And that person is going to start putting a lot of pressure on the technology side of the house and just keep asking, well, why are we paying people to do this when we can outsource it for a fraction of the cost?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the story that I read in the BBC website pointed out was that Google's saying that many of the universities who are leading the way in this area, who are signing on to their service, have signed on to their service first, are universities in the third world, and they point out universities in Egypt and Rwanda and Kenya who are ditching whatever servers that they had for Gmail service, that Gmail or Google can provide these services, can provide sophisticated services that they can't provide for themselves. That same cost savings, you know, it's not just a third world cost savings. It can happen here for small universities, community colleges that have tight budgets, state universities that have tight budgets.
Everybody has tight budgets,
yeah,
with very few exceptions. And it just seems to me that the cost savings there. Of course, there is. I do think universities feel that they need to sort of have all their stuff in a way. You know, they should have possession of students' email. And these sorts of things. And obviously, you know, we're not, you know, we like Google, but they're not perfect, and we have privacy concerns. And I'm sure people in the audience can think of many concerns that you would have in doing this kind of outsourcing. But, you know, I do think that it frees up costs to do other things. And I think there are a variety of technologies around, like web applications, OpenID for identity management, and single sign-on services. These sorts of things allow a university to have a kind of distributed data cloud or application cloud for students. And I think students, frankly, are used to that. They're coming in with, you know, their Facebook accounts and their Gmail accounts or Hotmail or what have you. They're used to stuff being in multiple places. And, you know, when we went to college, the university provided all this stuff. You had your university email, and that was it. And then eventually we got our own little web space, which was just a like Unix file system space to put up some web documents. But people are used to now, you know, they've got their own blog, they've got their own this and that. I think this is absolutely the future.
Yeah, and I think that the security concerns, and I think those are probably security, privacy, those are probably the big concerns with this kind of thing. Or at least that's the, if there's a knee-jerk reaction against these things, that's where the knee-jerk comes in. I actually think those aren't really very good concerns. I mean, it seems to me that Google can provide probably better security if they want to provide those services. They can provide better security and privacy services than a university can.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're talking about the economies of scale that they generate. If they're doing this for universities all over the world, they can provide a host of kind of a menu of security options for universities that a small shop on a small campus, or even a relatively large shop on a large campus, isn't going to be able to provide themselves.
Right. Well, finally, we saw the release of much anticipated real world. Well, I guess this is an object that marries the real world with the digital realm. And since we're all book lovers, I think we all found this very interesting, of these espresso machines and print on demand machines and news stories over the past few weeks. Looks like our good friend Josh Greenberg, who is at the New York Public Library, actually took possession of the first one of these books. This is it's called the Espresso Book Machine, or maybe that's its nickname, but it's basically a refrigerator-sized machine that you press a button and choose a book from many digital offerings, and it prints out a paperback book, I think, in about 5 minutes. And what's amazing is then you look at what else is going on. I mean, Google digitizing all these books and other, you know, Open Content Alliance and all these places digitizing these books and having effectively page images of these that are pretty high quality, although Google's might be a little bit less so. And then the ability to just sort of print this out if you actually want a physical copy. Do you think this is important, or have we moved so much online that people will no longer actually want the physical book? Mills, what were your thoughts reading these stories?
You know, I think that I think we're still a long way away from people not wanting the physical book. And I think what we're going to see is that increasingly the reference market is going to die, because you don't need to own all the reference books. Those sorts of books, you go and look up something, but that's different from the reading experience that, certainly the generation of people who are, 30 and over still really wants. And so, I think that that's going to, I think that books in their analog form will continue. Even if your book is on your iPhone, you don't want to really take it to the beach. And it's kind of hard to snuggle up in bed with your laptop. So it's, I think we're still a little ways away from the end of the book. You know, you guys probably don't even know this, but I've been on the editorial board of a print on demand press for the last couple of years. And I think this is really the future of academic publishing, because, so often now, in the history business anyway, the question is, well, what's the market for that book? And the answer is, well, almost none. If we're talking about a real market in the sense, selling 5,000 or 8,000 copies of some hardback book, the press that I work on has this new academia press, has the same exact process of scholarly review. It's all double blind and has a excellent editorial board and all of those things that you would expect from a major university press. However, they print 5 copies of the book when it's done and send those to the author, and then the rest of them are ordered directly through Amazon. And there's a press down in Nashville that big, I think it's called Lightning Press, and you order the book from Amazon and the order goes directly to the folks in Nashville, and the next book that comes out of the end of their press is the book that you just ordered. So it's like a warehouse-sized version of this espresso machine publishing system, and the book drops into an Amazon box and goes out in the next morning's mail.
Yeah, and it seems like Amazon is, that's an amazing process, gets beyond, publishers usually for academic monographs. I don't even know what the smallest print run is, but they probably only print out a few hundred copies of a lot of these hardback books.
Sure. And 500 is about the bottom end, I think.
Right. And then you think about all these, public domain books that are out there. It looks like both Amazon and then also a very interesting report, although I think it was a little bit of PR just for this research company called Outsell Incorporated, which speculated about Google possibly jumping into the print-on-demand world by, just printing out all these books that they've digitized, over a million books that they've already digitized. It really could open up the market for these sort of single print runs.
I was just going to say one other piece of this from an academic standpoint is that there are all these works of scholarship that are important, and they've gone they're no longer being printed, and right. So you can't acquire a copy anymore except by paying some outrageous amount through a used book dealer, and so one of the things that the press that I work with has done is encouraged authors to reclaim their copyright on a book that's no longer being printed, and then submit it to us, and then we simply set it up as print on demand, and so we're reintroducing books into the stream. Now we're doing it at this tiny little level. Dozens of books a year happening this way. Google is, as you say, scanning millions of books a year. And so I think it's quite likely that Google's going to do that. They'd be crazy not to.
It seems to me that, though, this is actually a bigger story. A lot of the talk about this print-on-demand has focused on, well, this is going to put bookstores out of business. And in fact, I don't think that's true. I actually think this is a much bigger story for the kind of scholarly, academic, educational community and educational market than it is for the kind of general book publishing market. I can't imagine that these machines, these Coke, you know, machine-sized machines, are going to be, you know, they're not really a substitute for the bookstore in the airport where you want to get a bestseller, you want to get it quickly. You're going to pull it off the shelf. They need lots of them. You know, they can't have people, each person waiting 5 minutes for a book to print. But it does seem like just the right thing for, as we were saying, you know, out of print books, textbooks where they're only doing a limited run for a course at this university or that university. It seems like that's really the model. And for that market, it seems like the model that Mills is talking about with the warehouse-sized machine where it, you know, maybe takes a day or two to get you the book is the model that's going to work rather than this kind of Coke machine model where you're actually standing in the library getting your book. It seems like for the kinds of books students, teachers, scholars need, they're the kinds of books that you can wait a day for. So I wonder, you know, this print on demand, it's definitely coming. It's definitely important. It's just going to be interesting to see what sort of shape it takes. Is it going to be the Coke machine or is it going to be the warehouse?
Well, I think we'll definitely keep track of this story as it develops and actually try to get a book from Josh and see what these things look like as they come out the other side. So, we'll keep on top of this on the podcast. As we just discussed with the new Espresso book machine, you know, part of its power is that it's leveraging all the digitization that's gone on. And we've really noticed, you know, that the amount of material available for researchers, digitized books and articles and images, has just exploded in the past few years. I mean, you look at JSTOR with more than 2 million scholarly articles from the past century, or ProQuest historical newspaper collection, 14 million pages of newspapers. Library of Congress with their online memory project has 9 million items now available online. And then, of course, Google Book Search, the big 800-pound gorilla with a projected 15 million volumes minimum in their catalog. And it seemed to us that it was important to discuss, as part of a feature for Digital Campus, just the opportunities and also the challenges that this poses to scholars and students and teachers. It's the size of this digitized collection of materials that we can study is really quite daunting. And, you know, Mills and Tom, the example I always like to use is the Clinton White House and the poor presidential historian who faces the task of looking through email messages produced by the administration. Well, it turns out that on their main server, there are 40 million email messages. And you sort of compare this number to, let's say, the number of letters that came in and out of, let's say, the Johnson administration or even earlier, Woodrow Wilson. It just dwarfs by several orders of magnitude, the scale of a corpus that a researcher faces. And the calculation I always like to throw out is that even if you could read one email message a minute, without sleeping, drinking a lot of coffee, it would take you 76 years to actually read all of those Clinton White House emails. And so we're really faced with, I think, what Roy Rosenzweig, our colleague and friend, wrote a great article for the American Historical Review a few years ago called Scarcity or Abundance. And he postulated that there are sort of two possible futures in a digital realm. One is a world of scarcity where, because digital things are very fragile and a lot of things aren't digitized, and we have all these born digital materials like email that are deleted and lost, that we might end up with a kind of digital dark age or scarcity, a world of scarcity where we don't have a lot of materials to look at. And the other possible world that we face is one of abundance, where we do have all this stuff and it overwhelms us with its size. And I think it's pretty clear to us now that we've ended up in that in that latter world. And it seems to us that, you know, that in the next, you know, 5-10 years, really what we're going to be dealing with is, you know, how do you deal as a student, as a scholar, as a researcher, how do you deal with just the sheer abundance of this material? Mills, what sort of experiences have you had sort of with maybe a collection that was really large, and how you get through it, and what do you do as a scholar when you bump into this world of abundance?
Well, it's something actually we've just started working on with the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank project here at CH&M. We've, over the last year and a half now, have been collecting, almost 2 years, collecting the stories of Hurricane Katrina and Rita and collecting images that people submit. But now we've moved into a different phase, which is we're trying to collect other material that people have posted online. And our first target is the Flickr database of, you know, I don't know how many gazillion photographs at this point. And so we've developed a program that will essentially mine the Flickr database for everything with certain tags, and in this case the tags Hurricane Katrina, and at the same time have a Creative Commons license on them so that we can suck them into our database without having to ask permission. And the first pass at the database gave us over 68,000 images tagged Hurricane Katrina with a Creative Commons tag on them. So,
right, and that's a small subset of the total number that are tagged Hurricane.
It's a small subset of the total. And I'm sorry, it was 68,000 without the Creative Commons, and then when we went to Creative Commons, it took it down to 14,000. But the two of us who work on this project on a daily basis, we don't have time to go through 14,000 photographs and see whether they're actually of Hurricane Katrina or of someone's cat named Hurricane Katrina or. You know, who knows why they tagged it in that way. So we do, you know, we've got 14,000 photographs, but now we've got to figure out a way, in some sort of an efficient way, to go through them and decide which ones ought to be in our archive and which ones shouldn't be. And at this moment, we haven't arrived at a solution to that problem.
Right. Tom, what have you experienced in this realm of abundance?
I think the interesting thing for me is that, let's say 100 years of historical training and methodology has really, and this is another kind of take on Roy's scarcity and abundance, is that 100 years or more of historical training and historical methodology has really taught us to deal with problems of scarcity. When you're researching a topic in history, at least up until very recently, you're posed with the problem of not having enough sources, not having really enough sources to tell the story you would really like to tell, searching and finding that great crucial source that can help you tell your story. Now we have the opposite problem, this problem of abundance, and I think there's we need to start thinking, doing sort of a fundamental rethink in terms of training students to deal with that problem and creating tools for dealing with this. Because as Mills says, you can't just do it by flipping through these things yourself. You can't get your hands around it in that manual way. We're going to have to come up with automated ways to do this.
Yeah, and I think, all of us use Google every day and we appreciate its power. But I think in the realm of academia and museums and libraries, I think a lot of the searches we're doing are more complicated. I mean, trying to locate items of interest that you would like to study further. It's a more complicated process. So you're not, let's say, oftentimes a keyword might not be really helpful, right? Let's say you were, again, that presidential historian. And you wanted to do the history of the Clinton White House dealing with Al-Qaeda. Well, you could certainly Google, I guess, for Al-Qaeda if you had the Google index this entire collection. But, of course, it's broader than that, right? As historians, you want to know, well, the context of, let's say, fighting terrorism. What about, other angles to the story, financial transactions that the administration was trying to cut off that might not have the keyword Al-Qaeda in it? And all of the different spellings of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, would be very tricky to deal with. And so we have a question of synonyms and changing terms over time and all these issues to try to find documents of interest. So location is extremely difficult, I think, in a scholarly setting with a lot of materials, much harder than it is, I believe, on the web. And so I think that's really kind of one main phase that we need to tackle first, Tom, I think is exactly what you said.
Well, and our friend Bill Turkle, who we had on Digital Campus not too long ago, has been writing about this exact issue in his blog, Digital History Hacks, fairly recently, just over the last week and a half or so. And he's actually got a very interesting post on June the 27th about doing just what we've been talking about. In his case, he's got a data set of the Dictionary of Canadian Biography, and he wrote a program to essentially find the relationships between entries based on some criteria that he set. And, you know, the program, this Python program, which is only about, I just looked at it, it's about 30 lines of code, so it's pretty simple, came up with some very interesting clusters of entries based on the simple parameters that he set. And the parameters aren't about looking for locational clusters or that kind of thing. He was looking for things that just basic distance between the entries, and it worked pretty well. And so, and he says that in his post that to run this on the 80,000 entry Dictionary of Canadian Biography took just a small amount of time, just a little over an hour on his PC. And so that worked pretty fast.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. A similar example is some work that David Mimno, who's a PhD student in computer science, has done at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And he's been working on creating what he calls virtual shelves, which I think is just a terrific term for it, and it's a great idea. And basically what he's done is he's taken the books, the freely available books from the Open Content Alliance. So these are digitized books. They've been digitized by the Internet Archive and some libraries and Microsoft and Yahoo. They're all public domain works, and unlike Google, the Open Content Alliance makes these books fully available, so you can actually get the OCR text or the underlying text, not just the page images. And what he did is he actually ran the entire text of about 45,000 books through a process that essentially clustered them by topics rather than keywords. And so it really provided a sort of powerful insight into how you could sort of redo the library or redo the process of locating things. I mean, you know, you experience in a physical library is you go to a bookshelf, let's say you're looking for the history of canals. You'd go to a bookshelf and you'd try to look around near a book if you saw something of interest. What Mimno's project does is it sort of creates virtual shelves, and it does an incredibly good job of clustering books that wouldn't normally sit together on the bookshelves that you might want to look at, but you'd never find in a physical library, and you wouldn't find by keyword search. So you might cluster together books on, the social history of the canals, some financial systems that supported the canals and the rise of large modern banks in New York City, travel diaries, fiction, all these things that would be in probably on different floors in a library are all clustered together again and sort of using these text mining and analysis techniques. And I think those are the kinds of tools that we're going to need to explore to see how they can facilitate scholarship when you have such masses of information available to you.
And so I think tools are key, because I what I don't think we can expect of our students is them all to learn the kind of Python skills that Bill Turkle has.
Right, right.
You know, I think we need to, the people who do have those kinds of skills need to start thinking in terms of tools that can be extended to non-technical users, or at least less technical users, so that these kinds of data mining, text mining techniques can be put into the hands of ordinary humanists. That's where, and I think we need to be thinking more about that. And I think, frankly, there needs to be a lot more funding be provided for that kind of thing.
Yeah, that was my question as well. Where are these tools going to come from? Who's going to create them? Who's going to fund the process of creating them? And I think it's really a next step for those funding the digital humanities to really think seriously about, because you know, a lot of money's been put into digitizing humanity's collections, but now we have the abundance problem.
Right. And I think that, you know, as a sort of second part of this question, and something that makes this world different than, you know, printed works, and where I think the espresso book machine might not help out as much as it possibly could in the future, is there is something special about having these things in digital form that is lost when you actually end up printing it out. There's some things gained. You can take it to the beach, et cetera. But I think a lot of what people are going to want to do, and people have already started discussing this, is you want to extract information from these books. You want to mash them up with maps or other applications. You want to contribute to sort of social bookmarking tools. So you want to be able to you know, share them on different, you know, Konatia or our Zotero project, or, you know, network them together. I think that those kinds of applications of being able to kind of pull important information out of it, aggregate it across different sources, that's really enabled by abundance as well. So we don't want to, you know, simply locate the books with, you know, virtual shelves is great for doing that, and then print them out and read them. We also want to go a next step, right, beyond that, which is locating them using computational methods to analyze them, extract information from them, summarize them, perhaps translate portions that are, you know, if you don't speak the language that they're written in, if you want to, you know, quickly scan a table of contents in a German book and you don't speak German, you want to just get a quick sense of what's in the volume. These sorts of things of sort of acting on the text as well is really enabled, and that's a very exciting possibility. Well, I think that a sort of third area that I think we're going to look at in this area is also sort of, you know, the digitization process itself and what happens there. I mean, we talked about Open Content Alliance making their text available, but I think really for this to take off, you know, right now what saddens us is that, you know, Google, with all these books, has not made their stuff available. And in fact, I just saw today this sort of third leg of the stool, as it were, is that CLEAR, the Council on Library and Information Resources, is actually now doing a study of Open Content Alliance, Google's project, and some of these other big digitization projects to see, you know, how they can be done in a way to encourage and enable scholarship. And I think that's really exciting. There was a piece by Peter Brantley on the O'Reilly Radar on this. And I think the outcome of that study will be, I think, a very important one to see, you know, for other people who wanted to do, you know, who want to do digitization projects, you know, how can you do it in a way so that the text is scanned and made available in a way that really enables all of what we've discussed? Because after all, if you're just Google and you just make page images available, you're not helping out at all.
Right. And even just providing, you know, full text may not be enough. That it may be that these large digitization projects that are putting all of this text into, well, XML documents or into a database, they need to be providing the kinds of hooks into that database, into that data, that digital humanists can use to pose their own research questions. As we said, the kind of brute force of a Google search is great and incredibly powerful, but even more powerful are the APIs that Google is now starting to provide. And if they could provide those same kinds of APIs for their large scale book digitization and article digitization projects, that would be even better.
Right. I think that we can't rely on the collection owner's own interfaces into the materials. I think at the very least there need to be APIs or application programming interfaces so that we can interact with those texts in a variety of ways. So new tools that we build can come along and scan them, can extract information, can combine it. If these things are just locked up, you know, Google Books isn't gated in that you can access it on the web. But in another sense, it is kind of gated, a sort of soft gating, in that, you know, they've got all the text index and we can't really access it, but we can look at the page images. So they're providing access at 3 a.m. if we want to take a look at a book, we can look at the book, but we can't do the kinds of computational analysis, extraction, location algorithms that we create, like Mimno's virtual shelves. We can't do that right now on Google Books. And I think that's something that we're really going to have to track, and I'm really looking forward to this report from CLEAR. So we'll see where this all goes, but I think, you know, abundance is certainly a theme that we're going to be tracing over the next few years on the podcast, and we'll see where it heads. Well, we've come to the end of the show, and as we like to do each episode, we'd like to just go around the horn and discuss any links or resources or software that we found that might be helpful for the audience. Tom, what did you have for the week?
I always have two things. I've got two things. The first one is something called Learning 2.0 that was first put out by the Public Library of Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and it's called Learning 2.0, but it's kind of confusing. It's also called 23 Things. And what it provides are 23 small exercises that you can do on the web to expand your knowledge of Web 2.0. And this isn't going to be really that interesting for digital campus listeners, I don't think, but it'll be kind of elementary. It's kind of 23 things that you can do on the web to help you understand, you know, the latest in Web 2.0 technology. I imagine that the listeners already know most of this, but it could be something that they could give their students or their staff members, to kind of a new staff member or something, to bring them up to speed on what's kind of going on in Web 2.0 and give them a kind of lay of the landscape and help them learn some of the lingo that we all kind of throw around. It's got a horrible URL, as all these things do, and so I'll put it in the show notes, but it's 23 Things Learning 2.0 from the Public Library of Charlotte-Mecklenburg. The other thing I had was I can just do this really quickly, I noticed yesterday was a little hack on Lifehacker. It's actually a little JavaScript that you can add to Google Docs to enable there's actually some hidden JavaScript in Google Docs, and if you cut and paste this code into your address bar when you're using a Google document, it actually adds dictionary and thesaurus functionality into Google Docs. It's kind of hidden in Google Docs. They haven't put the menu on the page yet, but it's actually hidden in there. And it seems to me that like a dictionary and a thesaurus are kind of essentials to make Google Docs useful for for scholars, and it's actually in there. It's just hidden, and this gives you a way to unlock that.
Huh, so it sounds like it's gonna that will come eventually, and you won't need.
Yeah, it looks like
you won't need the hack at some point. But yeah.
Right, it looks like something that they're testing. But but you can have it now if you just. I'll put the URL in the show notes.
Okay, great. Mills, what do you have for this episode?
Mine for today is a blog, a fairly new blog called The Electronic Museum: Thoughts on Museums, the Social Web, and Innovation. Written by someone in the UK, and it is really an excellent blog about the intersection of museums and information technology. He's done a lot of work. The author's done an awful lot of work on mashups and ways that this can really transform the museum experience. And so it's a lot of really critical thinking by this author, Mike Ellis, on how the museum is going to evolve over time, and of particular relevance to the discussions we've been having on digital campus. His most recent post is about a discussion among museum tech people about the sudden rush to set up Facebook accounts for their museums and whether this is even a good idea or not.
It looks like a great blog. I just dialed it up. So it's a terrific recommendation. Well, for this week, actually, it sort of relates to our question of abundance. I think this is a great site to get a sense of both abundance and also ways of sort of searching through it and also extracting information and learning from a large corpus. And this is a very large corpus of American English. It's actually more than 275,000 articles from Time magazine from 1923 to the present. And it's on a Brigham Young University website. I'll include the URL again in the show notes. And you can look through it and for keywords. You can, in fact, create a sort of frequency analysis by the decade of when terms show up. So you can look at the rise of terms like political correctness in it. And it's really, you know, fun to play around with. And I think it also could be used in the classroom pretty well if you're doing 20th century, you know, American culture or history. It's a terrific corpus to sort of try things out on. So, again, it's available online, and I'll put the link in the show notes. Well, again, we want to thank everyone for joining us, and want to wish everyone a happy 4th of July. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.